And so we're going to do just kind of a really short two-week series. And if you look, it looks kind of mysterious here, kind of the numbers. And some of you are wondering, you know, is this like October 10th, 1980? I mean, what's he talking about here? And it's not. In fact, for the curious, I did actually look that date up on the internet, and hardly anything happened unless your birthday's there. Anyone's birthday, October 10th, 1980. And so, good, we don't have anyone in the room. But a couple of earthquakes happened in Algeria, for the curious, and a guy named Noah Lowry was a left-handed starting pitcher for the San Francisco Giants. His birthday is October 10th, 1980. So there, you got the trivia stuff out of the way. But what do we mean by this? You can write some of this stuff in. What does 10-1080 mean? It will bring a lot less stress in your life if you'll do this. These are biblical principles, and you can write these in. The first 10 is tithe to God. Tithe to God. That's the first 10%. This is a biblical principle. Now, it's not going to be a command, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. It's a biblical principle. The other one, the other 10, is paying yourself 10%. And, boy, I know some of you that are older now, if you could figure out a way to instill in those that you influence, a younger generation, to start figuring out a way to do it now, and they just don't think there's any way they could do that. But if you can help them start to figure that out, it'll be a tremendous blessing in their life. Will it not down the road? You know it will be. And so these are valid, valid principles. And then the 80 just means living within your means. And this whole idea of learning to live on the other 80, some of you go, man, I can barely live on 100% right now. You'd be surprised if you understand these are biblical principles, how God can help you to live within this 10-10-80. I guess you could call it a formula that we have here. Now, my wife and I, we've tried to live within this for a long, long time. I ended up with two BAs, two college degrees. It would be a Master of Divinity, which is equal almost to a Doctorate of Education degree. And while we were in graduate school, she was working, I was working. And then when we got out to our first assignment, we qualified for welfare. Okay? And so that's kind of how the world of the ministry, you get all the college degrees and graduate degrees, and then you find a part-time job to fulfill God's call. And I'm not whining. We were so happy with whatever we were doing. But we continued to try to do what we're talking here, to live on the 10-10-80, and we had to make some radical job adjustment living style adjustment things. But, you know, we were able to do that. And over the years, sometimes the second 10 is trimmed a little bit as we've increased the percentage that we've given to God. But that was just a thing that we've wanted to do on our own. And this coming year, we're adjusting that again. The whole point here, these are not fast rules. These are not fast commandments. These are God's wisdom for us. But we live in this time where he just loves us so much, and he wants to give us advice, and he wants to help us have good life. So write down some of this. These biblical principles provide a sure strategy for getting love right. For getting love right. Because God understood, even in the early, early days of the Old Testament, that there are poor people, there are people of need. There were people that needed our help. And so those who were tremendously wealthy that had their own crops, when they would go to harvest their crops, it was fitted within the tithing principle, is they didn't harvest all the way to the corners. You'd have a square parcel. They would kind of harvest in a circle to where the outer corners would be left, to where the poorest of the poor could go, and they could glean some grain to have meals for themselves. You can see this in detail if you read the book of Ruth in the Old Testament, to where needs were able to be met for them. And so, again, I've learned over the years, like I said, we've oscillated a little bit, Pam and I, in this, but it's been a wonderful principle to work with. Now, fill this into generous people who are, here's a key word, who are also good stewards. These are in your notes, by the way. If you don't have New Life, these little notes, you can raise your hand. Somebody try to get that to you. And they'll run around. I think they'll fold them up in an airplane and shoot it to you, if that's okay. But this whole idea, generous people who are also good stewards of financial resources. You know what? Typically, listen to this. This is my observation, and I think it is biblical principle. Typically, they have healthier relationships. They do. You know, one of the things that's a predictor of an unhealthy marriage is when she has her finances and he has his finances. They've done major studies on this, and when she kind of keeps her business and he kind of keeps his business, that you're creating rule, you're creating a wall there where God says you are one. And the question you have to push, why are you even doing that in the first place if you're married? Now, another predictor is if you have one person that keeps all of the finances a secret from the other spouse, says, I will take care of all this and I will give you your allowance when you need it. That's another predictor too. Now, if there's a preference there, if people have worked things out where I don't want to know and I will ruin our finances if I have to do the books for even 10 seconds. You know, and if you both know that and you respect each other in that, that's another deal. But the point here is this. You can have generous people. And they're people, sure, you bet. We should give them this money. We should do this and that. But they don't understand the value of money. The gift isn't near as significant. Does that make sense to you? I mean, you've heard of people that won a lottery and they're end up broke 7 years later because they give money to everybody and friend. And you can have people who are good with money, but they're not generous. They're stingy and they're chintzy. And one of the most unconfessed sins of the New Testament and Old Testament is greed. And we have a way of really, you know, posturing when really it's just greed. And so you have people really good with money, but they're not generous. They don't have healthy relationships either, generally speaking. They have more turbulence, more problems. Sure, they can have, their mama still loves them and whatever. But what I'm saying, as a general principle overall, if you want to be abounding and rich in love, getting love right, there's this blessing that happens when you learn how to value and be good stewards of the physical world around us, which, you know, runs with money, 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 okay? But at the same time, you're generous. You understand the value of this, so you understand the value of the gift. What happens when you're that type of person? You'll start to value your relationships that way. You'll realize relationships are something I need to invest in. You realize relationships something I don't want to have high risk over. I want to have security around my relationship. I want to put a hedge around those relationships because I value those relationships and I'm going to give of myself in those relationships. You see, if you're not faithful in the little things, how can God bless you in the more important things? In fact, that's kind of what Jesus says here. So if you look at Luke here, very fascinating stats on the New Testament dealing with stuff and money and with Jesus. In fact, I was just reading around a little bit with the passage we're going to look at, and in Luke 15, you have three different stories. The story of a woman who lost her coin, and actual coins were rare for the poor to have, and then someone who lost their property, that is a sheep, and then a young man who had a financial fallout with his father on his inheritance. And so all those stories had to do with finances and with stuff, either directly or indirectly. And then we get into the chapter, on Luke 16, and we're going to see a story at the beginning about this shrewd manager, and then we're going to come into the passage in Luke 10 through 13, what we're going to look at. And then if you look on down, you'll find about the rich ruler. The rich ruler. So all of these things, because there's this kind of objection in our American culture, and that is the church is more interested in my wallet than they are in me. And usually that's a pretty unfair leveling at the church, but pastors have to be really cognizant of the American culture in which they're in, because if there's an area that's kind of a taboo in American culture, there is this unspoken, deeply held, listen, deeply held conviction. It's a heartfelt, deeply held, deeply rooted conviction. But it doesn't mean it's true. But it's deeply felt, deeply held, deeply believed, deeply held onto, and it's this: my money's my business. And so there's already kind of a built-in defiance to want to hear. And I think maybe it was a little bit like that in Jesus' time, for the fact that one in seven verses deals with stuff and money. in the New Testament. 1 in 7. 1 in 7. All right. I'm waking you guys up here, especially 8:30, 11:30 crowd too. I want you to do this right now. Kinesthetic learners, you're going to love this, okay? All right, everyone do this. Ready? And then the other one is? Okay, now I want you to turn to the person next to you and do that. I want you to say, 1 in 7. Would you do that right now for me? Ready? On the count of 3. 1, 2, 3. 1 in 7. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so this idea of, oh, I picked the wrong Sunday to come here. You know? If I want to teach the way Jesus taught, you'd have a 1 in 7 chance. Okay? Because 1 in 7. Look, there's about 500 verses on prayer. How important do you think prayer is to a follower of Jesus? It's about 500 verses, about less than 500 verses on faith in the New Testament. There are over 2,000 verses in the New Testament on money and stuff. Shocking, but it's true. Jesus said, he alluded to money in over 50% of his analogies and stories in one way or another. And the idea of economics or economic justice, somehow it comes up in over 50%. And 15% of what Jesus taught in the New Testament was laser focused on the issue of finances and money. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that is? This is some of what he taught. Now we're back to Luke 16 here. He says, if you're faithful in little things, you will be faithful in large ones. I think little things here, he means money. He calls that the little thing. We see that as the biggie. He sees that as the little thing in context of your money is only good on planet Earth in this one solar system in the Milky Way galaxy. Okay. He has a little bit bigger perspective on how this whole thing works. But if you're dishonest in little things, you won't be honest with greater responsibilities. I remember when I lived in Oregon, lived right on the beach, and sometimes I'd go to this place called Sunset Beach and watch the tide come in. And I saw this young teenage girl in a brand new, decked out, I don't know, it's like four-wheel drive Ford pickup or Toyota pickup or something. And she had her boyfriend with her, and she's kind of showing off, you know, spinning some donuts on the beach there. And then got down closer to the water. And all of a sudden, you know, I was walking with my kids. We started to see the wheels, back wheels starting to spin out. And then she got out, fiddled with the front. And then all of a sudden we saw four wheels starting to spin out. And she's getting stuck. And you saw this high-rise pickup starting to get lower and lower. And then she wasn't getting out of it. And then I started to notice the tide was coming in. Tide was coming in a little bit more. And I went over to try to help her. I did everything I could. And we finally left when a wave hit the side of the truck. And she got out. She says, my dad doesn't know I took the pickup. He's forbidden me to use his good cars because I always end up in trouble driving his car. So I can only drive his old car. He doesn't know I'm here. He's going to kill me and whatever. I never know what happened the rest of the story. All I know is I was morbid enough to stick around to where all I saw was water. The pickup was gone. It was completely hidden. It was really a sad story. And you know, I know with my kids, I didn't let my kids, when they're learning to drive, drive my new car right away. But as they showed themselves faithful, like, you know, early on, you know, it didn't take a long time, where whenever we drive to San Francisco or whatever, I let my son drive. He's way better doing that than me. And I can just kind of sit back and whatever. And so the whole idea is if you're untrustworthy about worldly wealth, who will trust you with the true riches of heaven? What do riches here on earth tend to be for some of you? Do you just go on Craigslist to get someone to do childcare for you? Yeah, I'll watch your kid. You know, $2 an hour. Great, what a deal. When can you come over, you know? Some of you are going, oh, I shouldn't do that. No, you should not, okay? All right. You know, but no, you need to know who it is. They have to be trustworthy. But that's dealing with your kids, so that's your treasure. This is what Jesus is saying. If you're not faithful with other people's things, why should you be trusted with things on your own? Now, I alluded to Luke 16, 1 through 9. It's not in your notes. But this has to do, it's very interesting story about a shrewd scoundrel. In fact, everyone in the story are scoundrels. But what you can glean from this story, and I'm not going to be able to get the detail, he just kind of was a shyster, and he's kind of crafty and kind of how he manipulated people to jockey himself to his advantage. By he was a slave, and he used his master's money to pay off other people. He was generous, using money that wasn't really his to make himself look good. That's kind of the premise of the story. But the thing behind that is how much attention these crafty people are using in this area of money for their own advantage. How much more if we put the same kind of creative energy into being compassionate and generous toward other people? If we put that same amount into that and we invested as we do into energy invested, what we do in worldly activities would be put into kingdom activities. I was reading the Harvard Business Review this week. And I do stuff like that once in a while. And one of the titles of the article is "The Job No CEO Should Delegate." And they have all these just very earnest titles and you know, the new challenge for the new CEOs. And if you want to be a manager that's progressing to the next step and, you know, how to do this and that. And there's things on. And if you're curious, it's interviewing. CEOs should still interview. I know some of you are curious out there for that. So, okay. And communications, you know, issues on customer loyalty and creative collaboration, innovation, strategy, competition, all these things are so good. And God honors and cares for good stewardship in the workplace. Here's the reality is when we talk about stuff like this, the idea of how money is a deal that is compassionate toward others, how money is the deal that can cause huge stress in your life, and how the Bible has very, very clear wisdom on this, both for your life personally. You kind of get the mindset of, you know, what's this about? You want to talk about my money? I'm showing up here. Isn't that good enough? You know, I'm privileging you to grace you with my presence here, John. So, you know, what else do you need? See, but God has something so much, and this is the whole point of this whole deal that Jesus talked about. He said this. Look at Luke again here. In verse 13, this is the crux of it. He said, you might think you could be in control and you can handle this, but it's going to end up, it'll become more and more clear one way or another. You cannot serve two masters, and there are only two. And we tend to think, oh, serve God or myself. And he doesn't say that. He says, you're going to serve God or you're going to serve money. For you will hate the one and love the other. You'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. You know, a lot of people can handle more than one job. We have a lot of people at New Life here that have a full-time job, and then you have like a part-time job. Maybe the part-time job's more of a hobby, or it's just something that you're interested in, or whatever. But you know what? You know what? If the boss of your full-time job, or your full-time wage, calls, or the guy that's in charge of your part-time job, that's maybe 10 hours a week in your hobby, and the full-time guy is saying, I need you, and the part-time guy saying, I need you, who are you going to go toward, huh? Yeah, absolutely. You're going to go toward the full-time guy. Why? Because that's where your income really, really is. And so if you put the reality of that, God cannot be a part-time commitment. He can't be. And it doesn't mean that you have to be in full-time service. Your job, wherever you're at, can be your place of full-time ministry. And it might be that actual God where he's actually using your mouth or focus on someone else might only be a couple of minutes during that day, but it's a potent time. But you're on call the whole time. And God has you on loan doing these other jobs and these other things. But at any given time, he says, I need to use your voice. I need to use your ears to listen to someone. I need to use your body and your attention and your talents to build a kingdom. And I need you right now. Okay? That's where we really need to bet. I'm not saying you walk off the job at that point and tell your boss, God just told me I'm supposed to leave right now for an hour. I'm not saying that. But this whole idea is this, throughout the idea of tithing, generosity defined, the principle of tithing is thinking of giving toward others first. That's really what this is about. And in fact, there's one other verse on this I just want to bring up to you in Luke 16. But that doesn't mean that the law has lost its force. It's easier for heaven and earth to disappear than for the smallest point of God's law to be overturned. Okay, let me give you the context of that. Jesus get this talk about serving two masters, and if you look at your chapter there, he gets into another kind of argument with these legalistic religious people, but they want to talk about something else, and actually this is about money. This is about sexism too. These are men who are wanting to define in the Bible, is there any loopholes how we can, you know, continue to do the law of the Old Testament but find an easier way to divorce our wives? That's really what the discussion's all about right there. And so there's this whole idea of wanting to split hairs of interpretation, and Jesus just finally puts up his hand and he says, look, you guys, you need to get the intent of what this whole Old Testament law thing was about, and it was about love, ultimately. That's what it was about. It was about the heart. It was about love. And people try to do this. The whole point of, I put this verse in here, people today try to do the same thing about tithing, what they were trying to do about divorce and about marriage. Well, what does it literally mean there? Is this really something for us today, or is this something for that then? And they don't get this whole thing. So look, it says here, look at your notes. Jesus did not command us to tithe, but he did command us to store up treasure. He did command us to store up treasure. Jesus taught, stop storing them up in the wrong place and start storing them up in the right place. So love always calls us for more than just the law. It's always something much more generous. So here's the context where it says, so the point, the spirit, that's where you're getting at. The spirit of the law is throughout the whole New Testament. And so when someone says, well, the idea of tithe is an Old Testament Bible, and people turn into these amazing Bible scholars on just this one point. At least they want to sound intellectual on it, okay? And they're going, well, that's an Old Testament thing and whatever. Well, really, the spirit of the law is what we want to look at. That's what Jesus is talking about. He says the spirit of the law is, you might have this thing deciphered in the Old Testament about how to quickly divorce a wife you don't want to have around anymore. Okay, and you want to use that same thing toward being generous, you know, because they talk about the Old Testament thing of the tithe, you know, that 10% thing. But he says, I got to tell you, there is a spirit of the law here on that. So what we're looking at here on this is Jesus' words in Matthew 6, 19 through 21. It's in your notes, conveniently for you. Jesus says, don't store up treasures here on earth where moths eat them and rust destroys them, and where thieves break and steal. You know, we put so much energy here. Have you ever seen, it's on PBS, the idea of the antiques, I think the antique show or something like that. And all these people come with all these little treasures. And sometimes it's just shocking. Someone had these little vase things from China that they bought for a couple hundred dollars back in the, you know, when they were in the Korean War, whatever. And it was worth $1.3 million. And they were being used as paperweights in their office and let their grandkids play with them, you know. And so the idea, we're amazed about treasures like that. But look, the Bible never condemns riches. Do you understand that? In fact, Abraham, one of the most amazing leaders, original leaders. In fact, he tithed before there was the Old Testament law to tithe. Okay, so there's already a spirit of tithing there. It says when he died and he was buried, it says he was a very rich man, that this was a good thing, that God had blessed him. So there's nothing ever condemning riches per se. But what Jesus is saying is from the heart, your intent should be to store your treasures in heaven, where moths and rust cannot destroy and thieves do not break in and steal. You know, sometimes we have unnecessary collections that, if you think about it, could feed thousands of people, if you think about it. Wherever your treasure is, there the desires of your heart will also be. So this is kind of the foundational thing, and it's easy now to run through these three little steps to put perspective on this, because we're talking about 10, 10, 80. And so today we're going to talk just for a few more minutes about the first 10, and then next week we'll continue to talk about the second 10 and the 80, because what this series is about is laying a foundation of hearing the voice of God in your life. And as you're hearing the voice of God in your life, it will bring a foundation for long-term joy, long-term peace, and long-term commitment, which is a tremendous legacy to pass on to those younger than you. You know, to teach them the value of money, to teach them the discipline and joy of generosity. Look, you don't have to have children of your own here. You could be definitely a mentor to all kinds of different people. And so let's look at these just a little bit. And so really what we are talking about, the first one is return. Return to God your first 10. That's really kind of the great principle that we're looking at here. You will not find a command in the New Testament, thou shalt tithe. Just like you will not find in the New Testament a command, thou shalt not murder. It's not in there. You'll have it listed in sins and things like that. But you're not going to see a definitive command that says, you know, you shall not, you know, have physical abuse beat your children. You will not see that command. It says, fathers, don't bring your children to wrath. You know, don't exasperate your kids. Because some of these things are just so unspoken, it's like, duh. Within what the community of faith, the community of love, should be about. That being said, it's a great principle. The definition of tithe is derived from the Hebrew word aser, and there's actually a couple of words on this, which means to give a tenth part of. And so this becomes a great guideline, aspirational guideline, a first steps guideline of generosity. It says, you know, if the Old Testament's like this, how much more should we be generous toward other people? Exodus 23:19, to refer to the Old Testament, bring the best of the first fruits of your soil to the house of the Lord your God. This is an agricultural society, so much of their currency came from crops. I grow grapes, you grow grain. So let's barter, let's trade. But they would the way they would give to God was through the local temple. And then they would also be able to distribute and help the poor, the aliens that were coming through their country who are dispossessed. Israel was starting the process of being a compassionate country like none other in that very brutal time, a long, long time ago when these stories are taking place. The whole point here is you don't bring the leftovers. You don't bring the leftovers to the temple. So it's kind of like if you're to invite company over, and then when they come through the door, you say, hey, sit down, you guys. And then you swing open your refrigerator door, and you pull out this gnarly cardboard box, and you set it down on the table, and you open it up, and there's kind of bent four-day-old pizza, okay? And you say, okay, you guys, you know what? If you microwave that and you eat it really, really fast, I think it's going to taste okay. Is there any green on there? You would not think of that. If you invite people over, that's when you bring out the good dishes a lot of times or whatever. And you just want to at least put some kind of good point, good impression forward. And so this is what we mean by first fruits. It's the first thing you think of. Someone, you know, could say things like, well, I tithed $20 last week. Well, if you made $200 that week, then you did tithe $20. But if you gave $20 and you made $1,000, you didn't tithe. So this is the beginning of a foundation. Tithing is not about God needing our money. This is a powerful principle in our lives. It's acknowledging our dependence on God. That's what this principle is about. Not command, but it's a principle. Powerful statement of faith, biblical principle that releases God's blessing in our life. I really believe this. You know, we do have things to offer people that are struggling with their finances, and we've seen tremendous stories at New Life. One of them, but not the only one, but one of them is Dave Ramsey, and we have a thing called Financial Peace, and in an interview with him, he was talking with a pastor friend of mine, and he said that he can't explain how or why, even with the numbers, but he says there just appears to be a spiritual blessing on people, and somehow in the spiritual realm, who trust God in the area of a tithe in their life toward others. I mean, a true tithe on their income, not defining, I'm going to call this my income, even though this is all my assets, this is everything, I'm going to call this my income, and I'm going to tithe off that. No, I mean a true tithe, a true tithe. There seems to be a spiritual blessing, and I can attest to that. And for us, Pam and I, we've tithed, you know, from the beginning of our marriage, whether by check or by cash, you know, or online, or which we do now. I'm not talking about tithe because New Life needs your money. I'm really not saying that. We do operate off the contributions of others, but that is not the main reason at all. I'm talking about tithing as beginning steps to generosity for the sake of you growing spiritually. Because why would Jesus talk so much about this? He knows how close money and your spiritual growth is. He understands that. It is a big step. You know, God's blessed us with a new location out on I-80. And God is calling generous people to take the leadership because so many other people are in tremendous need. So, you know, we're calling a new core group, a holy group, a holy core group of people. Who are those people? People who, by circumstances, you've become a part of New Life right now for such a time as this. And everyone who calls New Life their church family, you're going to be called to a higher level of spiritual growth and spiritual obedience because you need to be there. But other people need you to be there too because they don't have a clue how much they need God in their life. Some of you, though, you're going to stop. You're going to get stuck. And that's just how it kind of works. In fact, a guy named Martin Luther lived a long time ago. He wrote about there are three conversions that people really seem to have. The first is kind of a head conversion, and that is, I believe in God. You know, I kind of believe in the God thing. So that's kind of a conversion of the head. I sent to believe in this. The other is the heart, and that is you kind of invite Jesus into your life. And for some of you, it's a radical warm feeling, and you look back since you've really been doing that and doing kind of this, you know, become part of church family. You see so many positive, beneficial things. A lot of people get stuck, though, because there's a conversion of the pocketbook. A conversion of the pocketbook, how it impacts your life and security. So where are you at, new lifers? Have you had a conversion of the head? Conversion of the heart? Conversion of the pocketbook? One of the guys I used to always look at, his name was Criswell, pastored a phenomenal church in Texas, and he's getting ready to baptize this guy, and this guy got down, he's getting ready to get the wallet. Oh, I forgot to take my wallet out, and Criswell, this is why I like the guy, Criswell grabbed the guy by the lapels and just threw him under the water. He just threw him under the water, and he pulled him out, and he said to the guy, I've always wanted to baptize a pocketbook, you know, because that's where we get stuck. He says, here, let me leave my pocketbook back. I want to belong to Jesus, but not my pocketbook. See? And so there are multiple conversions. Proverbs 3, 9, and 10. Honor the Lord your wealth with the first fruits of your crops. Then your barns will be filled to overflowing. Your vats will brim over with new wine. And this is a principle with general consequence and promise. In fact, one great author said that you know what the barns are? The fill the barns of other people. Bring your crops and fill the barns of other people. It's the mouths of the poor and the hungry. And they become the barns that become filled for laying up a treasure in heaven for us that have resources in our lives. And you know, I've talked about this principle of 2 billion people live on less than $2 a day. But as convenient as this is no longer appropriate. I think it's closer to this. But it's still this is what they live on. So I don't know, that's hard to do right here. But you know what? So let's continue. Realize that generosity is not about God getting stuff from us. This number two is how God helps us to see the truth of what is in our own heart. That's what this is about. And so as I'm talking today, Can you kind of monitor your own attitude right now, what you're feeling, and your little arguments that are going on in your mind as I'm talking up here, you know, your list of yes buts and whatever? Can you do that? Or if you're moping, feeling, you know, if you're turning this to feel sorry for yourself right now, don't do that. Don't do that. Just listen and look at the truth. You know, if it were another area, if you're being an awful husband, don't turn that into feeling sorry for yourself. I'm just such a horrible husband. No. Just improve. Be a better husband. But don't self-punish yourself and then not change. Does that make sense to you all? Okay. All right. Not in the notes. All right. Realize that generosity is not about God getting stuff from us. It's how God helps us to see the truth of what's in our own heart. In fact, the Bible talks about this. 1 John 3:16 through 18. We know what real love is because Jesus gave up his life for us. That's more than money, isn't it? So we also ought to give up our lives for our brothers and sisters. If someone has enough money to live well and sees a brother or sister in need but shows no compassion, how do you show compassion? Don't watch it on TV and then feel really, really bad. That's not compassion. You know, don't you know, look at someone in a circle, oh, I just feel so awful for those people. And then drive on and have a tear, but do nothing. See, Americans, many times, compassion has everything to do with emotions. Biblically, it has little to do with emotions and everything to do with doing something about it. See, even though you're not saved by works, compassion defined in the Bible is way more practical than just feeling something but doing nothing. Some of you are strong feelers, but you have this really hardcore area where you're not changing at all, and you're very non-feeling. It's just non-negotiable. No. So, if someone has enough money to live well and sees his brother or sister in need but shows no compassion, how can God's love be in that person? What does live well mean? Well, it means more than living on $2 a day, that's for sure. Because some of you are going to look at this and go, yeah, if I can live well, I'll do that. You know what I mean? It's just, not us. Man, you know, our two cars and motorcycle, you know, they're not even within the last 5 years of models. You know, I don't know the last time I bought a computer. I don't even have an iPad yet, you know? So I'm not mocking you right now, but what I am saying, don't fall into the trap of some, you know, live well. Understand, we have already made it. We've already made it. Look at verse 18. Dear children, let's not merely say that we love each other. Let us show the truth by what? By our actions. Yeah. And so, you know what it's kind of like? Let's say there's a guy counseling someone, they're spitting quality, and the counselor, you know, a couple troubled, you know, in their marriage, whatever, and he says, you need to start spending some quality time together, start having regular dates. And let's say one of the spouses starts asking, well, what do you mean by regular dates? He goes, well, maybe once a week. He goes, once a week, okay, all right. How long does the date have to be? Okay. You know, I'm trying to put this in my smartphone here. It's 60 seconds, and you know, does it have to be over an hour and a half? Okay. Do I tithe on my net or my gross? Okay. All right. Do we have to spend money on this date? I mean, can we just go for a walk? You know, if the other spouse is hearing that, you know, and they only say, look, I'm just trying to define what it means to be a good spouse here, okay? So don't get on my back. It's not about me. You know, you're always guilting me. Because some of you are doing that with me right now. Boy, he's just guilting me right now. See? All right? And you're kind of feeling that. All right? But how would you feel if this guy saying you need to spend quality time, this person's trying to parse it, interpret it? Well, what do you really mean by being a good spouse? What do you really mean by quality time? You see what I'm saying? It's like bring it home a little bit more. Brent, bring it home. This is a matter of love, of the heart. And so I have people that that kind of talk this way. And so you need to rely on God, God's perfect love, number three, to overcome the fear of not having enough. Because I know this can seem kind of scary, this whole deal. We've been conditioned by our commercials to think that we never have enough, and it's never good enough. I mean, only in America does it make national news what kind of advertisements are going to be on the Super Bowl. You know, oh yeah, the next really snazzy thing to hook you to get you to spend money on their product. You know, great. The idea of corporations and making money and all that, I'm not against that. But what I am saying is, we get so fostered into thinking it's never enough. It's never enough. We're always kind of alarmed, and we're just always barely making it. And multi-billions of dollars have been spent to keep you in that mindset. 1 John 4:18, there is no fear in love. I am so busy. How in the world am I going to be able to spend quality time with my spouse? Oh, I just have too many things going on, and I don't have enough time to get everything done. How can I have quality time? The spouse is going to think then, well, then that stuff's more important than me. Would they have a good reason to believe that? Yeah, they would. Because our actions show where our treasure really is. I know we have a lot of baggage here. I get people say, I'm a New Testament giver. You know, this idea of the tithe is, you know, that's passé, that's Old Testament. And you know what they usually mean? What that usually is a signal for me and for them both? Well, I'm under grace, I'm a New Testament giver. What they usually mean, and everyone I've ever known here, doesn't mean it's not always the case, gives a lot less than a tithe when they say I'm a New Testament giver. Almost always. In fact, when I look at the Bible, though, you can't find anywhere in the New Testament where people give less than a tithe, at least that I can find. You know, you have the one lady, she goes and she breaks this really powerful perfume and, you know, puts it on Jesus' feet. They said it was a year's income. You have someone else, the widow, that gave her last coin, and Jesus was so impressed with what she did, and then Jesus said that was her last coin. Guess what that was? That was 100%. Okay, of her, didn't look like much, but for her, it was a lot. Barnabas from Cyprus was an investor, strong aspirations, probably his whole life because he was an encourager. He had this deep aspiration to make mega bucks because he was so giddy about liquidating assets and turning around and blessing other people. And it says he liquidated this huge parcel and laid it at the apostles' feet. I think that was more than 10%. And so, be a New Testament giver. Go for it. But I don't understand. New Testament giver doesn't say, wow, I'm so grateful for Jesus died on the cross for me, and that he rose again, and that he conquered death, that I have the hope of eternal life when I die, and I'll get to see my Christian loved ones someday, and I have purpose and hope and security in the uncertainties of life. So I think I'm going to lower my giving rate to 2.2%. Because that's where the average Christian in America is at today, is at 2.2%. The true attitude of a New Testament giver, because what God has already done for me, I know I can't outgive God because I know he's blessing me, and I'm going to increase my giving in light of what God is doing. So this is how you can test God, and this is the last thing you see there on your notes. And this is an Old Testament principle, but it's also a New Testament principle too. Okay? And it says, bring the whole tithe into the storehouse that there may be food in my house. Then it says, test me in this, God says, because other places he says, do not test the Lord your God. He says many times, but the only place he says, test me in this, and see if I will not throw open the floodgates of heaven and pour out so much blessing that you will not have room enough for it. Okay. Old Testament culture, they bring stuff to the temple, like I said before. And And so just let me give the point. The generosity is not about God here. It's about our hearts, okay? And so God is basically telling the guys here, so just have guts to close the door. If people are just coming and giving me their leftovers, you know, they give them like crops and lambs as a sacrifice. I know you don't understand all of that, but you're supposed to bring the best of the best. But what they do, they bring their crops that kind of had mold on the grapes, and they bring a little lamb. God bless the little lamb. It's kind of leaning up against the wall with its last bah in its mouth. They go, oh, that one will do right there. And, you know, bring it to the temple. God said, just shut the doors. You know what? If they just want to bring their $10, just tell them to keep it. Because I want their hearts. I want their hearts, and I've defined how to define their dependence on me. Now, some of you here, look, there are first steps like little toddlers, and that $10 is a big step of faith, okay? So I'm not saying, you know, do this whole thing or nothing. I'm not saying that for some of you, but there are so many here, you're not toddlers anymore. You're 20-year-olds trying to fit in diapers still. And on the outside, you have this veneer of just looking so competent and so successful and even so spiritual. But the truth of the matter is this area is just off limits. And you are, listen. You are allowing another person to influence you in this area of your life. And that's your treasure. And you just need to know it. But God loves you more. And he's the only one that has conquered death and gives you hope for a real future. You need to love him best. Because you might think that person's going to be there in your life forever. They may or may not be. And frankly, if you confess it in your heart, you're running scared a little bit. You never know if someone's going to be there or not. Jesus will never walk away from you. So you need to invest in that love relationship. And don't listen to someone else's argument. Don't listen to someone else's wisdom. Trust in the word of God, you guys. I've seen too many heartbreaks the other way. I have decided to follow Jesus. Though none go with me, still I will follow. God's blessing many times. If you start to follow, they'll respond and they'll follow you too. But if they choose not to, it's worth it. It's worth it, you guys.